Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming along tonight, where we've got a discussion on the Labor Party after the election with two of Australia's best known and most highly regarded journalists, Aaron Patrick and Chris Ullman. Now, Aaron Patrick studied arts. He did a Master's of Public Administration at Harvard. He's been the president of Young Labor at the time when Bill Shorten was in the organisation. But at the moment, he's deputy editor of the Australian Financial Review. And Aaron's recently published Downfall, How the Labor Party Ripped Itself Apart. So we'll lead off with Aaron on our general topic, which for tonight is called Labour After the 2013 Election, and we've asked Chris Ullman to comment. So both speakers will speak for about 15 minutes. Chris is well known to you. He has been political editor of 730. He graduated in arts. He says he was a failed seminarian. He says he was a failed many things, but he's never said he was a failed ABC journalist, which is nice, and nor has he been. And he's currently in the process of doing a documentary for ABC TV on the Australian government over the last 6 years, which is scheduled for release towards the end of next year. And Chris has also recently published, along with Steve Lewis, a thinly disguised novel called The Marmalade Files, an explosive novel of lies, lust and political bastardry. So Chris is from Canberra. So we'll lead off with Aaron, and we'll follow with Chris on the general topic of Labour after the election, and we'll have questions and discussion. Aaron Patrick, you're very welcome.
Thank you. Thanks, Jared, for that kind introduction. Well, here's a copy of my book, Downfall. I probably shouldn't say this because my publisher is in the audience, but I would have preferred if we'd kept an earlier version of the cover. Because it had a pole dancer here and Gina Reinhardt emerging from this hole in the ground. And my daughter, you know, the pole dancer was right next to Kevin Rudd, which was appropriate. My five-year-old daughter, when she saw it, asked why the woman was wearing high heels and underwear. And I think they took it off for legal reasons as much as taste. Downfall is an attempt to describe where the Labor Party went wrong. So everyone in this room knows the basic facts. The end of 2007... the Labor Party held power federally in every state. The most senior Liberal politician in the country was Campbell Newman, the Mayor of Brisbane. And at that point, Labor could justifiably claim to be one of the most successful centre-left political parties in the world. Now, given subsequent events, it's easy to forget the incredible euphoria and optimism generated by Kevin Rudd's defeat of John Howard in 2007. I was in London at the time, and I remember being at the Frontline Club for Journalists, and I overheard someone telling the New York Times bureau chief, John Burns, about this incredible woman, Maxine McHugh, who defeated a sitting prime minister. But don't be fooled by the recent civil tone of the Labour leadership contest, which obviously Bill Shorten won. Today, I would argue the Labour Party is still mostly in disgrace and retreat. The party is in opposition in New South Wales, Queensland, Victoria, Western Australia and Northern Territory. It's in serious trouble in South Australia and Tasmania, and it clings to power by one seat in the ACT. The defeat at the federal level on September 7th was so expected that it's easy to overlook just how badly the government failed politically. It was the first two-term government since Whitlam. It was the first to remove its leaders twice since Billy McMahon replaced John Gorton in 1971, and the party that created many of the core elements of the modern state, such as universal health care, social security, labour protection, multiculturalism, superannuation, low tariffs, now barely qualifies for party status in one of its birthplaces, which is Queensland. So what went wrong? There's a lot of various ideas out there or theories put forward by academics, politicians and journalists for Labor's malaise. You know, they include society's growing affluence and decline of class identity, or a lack of clear philosophy and reform agenda, internal disunity, union influence on the party and a de-unionising economy. And there's probably truth in all of these. But I have some of my own theories, my own explanations, and what I think is some of the behaviour that I think has driven the Labor Party's downfall has been attacking whistleblowers and internal dissidents, trashing the reputations of external opponents, unethical behaviour by party leaders before they became politicians, allowing people who may be criminals to wield significant political power, corruption. Now, you may think, or some other people may think, I'm being too harsh. But consider this. In October 2009, two reporters on the Australian Financial Review, Tracy Ong and Angus Grigg, published a front-page article entitled Labor Power Broker Hits a Rich Seam. And the article revealed that Eddie Obeid, the previous mining minister, had purchased a farm in the Bylong Valley that covered part of a newly issued coal licence. For $1 million, the Obeids had netted a profit of about $13 million, according to the article. Obeid told the reporters that he didn't know about the coal licence in advance and he just bought the farm because he liked the view. There was just one problem with the article, which was the Obeids weren't going to make $13 million from the farm. According to evidence that I calculated, the figure was more likely $100 million, perhaps even more if they converted it into an actual coal mine. Now, ICAC this year determined that Eddie Obeid and his son, Moses, are corrupt, and it's probably going to take years for the courts to either uphold or strike down that ruling. But the reality was that Eddie Obeid was one of the most powerful half-dozen people in New South Wales for at least a decade. He was the apex of power in the biggest state in Australia. He owned substantial, unexplained wealth. He was accused by a reputable newspaper of involvement in what appeared to be, at the very least, dubious behaviour. And he was a man who literally helped select three premiers. Now, who inside the Labor Party challenged Eddie Obeid and his partner in crime, Ian McDonald's, rights to be MPs? Who in authority stood up and said, why do we allow these sleazy figures to represent this party and the people of New South Wales? Well, Bob Carr didn't. Bob Carr put Eddie Obeid into cabinet and Ian McDonald. In fact, Bob Carr defended Obeid in court against allegations that Obeid had solicited a bribe for a property development. Carr portrayed Obeid as a victim of a smear campaign by the Sydney Morning Herald. Kevin Rudd and Julian Gillard didn't stand up to him. The secretaries and presidents of the New South Wales division of the Labor Party didn't. There was no evidence that any of the national or state union leaders tried to remove Obeid, McDonald or even Craig Thompson. Indeed, Sam Destiari, when he was the secretary of the New South Wales Labor Party, actively tried to dissuade a challenger from taking on Craig Thompson for pre-selection in the seat of Dobell before the 2010 election. Okay. Someone in the party who had the platform, some may even say the responsibility to take on them, took no action, and that was the president of the Labor Party. And the president at the time this article came out was Michael Williamson, who 2 weeks ago was charged with four counts of fraud and faces 30 years in jail. Okay. So for me, this sums up the Labor Party's problems. Almost no one in a senior level was prepared to stand up and stop the sleaze or fight the sleaze. Now, there's many things that need to change in the Labor Party, and this is just one unfortunate aspect of it. But one important solution is the party's got to democratise itself. Regular party members should no longer be treated as a free workforce for getting factional and union leaders elected each polling day. Thanks to Rudd's election reforms, that's already starting to change. The second change that the party needs may even be tougher. The party leadership at a state and federal level and the unions, which have so much power in the Labor Party, have to embrace something that a lot of people regard as antithetical to the political process, and that's ethics. That's high levels of ethical behaviour. reasonably high levels of ethical behaviour. So a lot of political experts argue that ethical behaviour or pushing it in politics is naive. They would say that politics is primarily about an ideological contest or a contest for allocation of resources. Look, I say ethics today, in a least in a democratic system, are a political necessity. Voters hate corruption, obviously, as they've shown in New South Wales with the punishment they handed out to Christina Keneally's government. And they don't like the other kind of behaviour that's become common in politics too. Special treatment for political allies and family members, lying, misrepresentation of opponents, and removal of democratic elected leaders because they've upset factional chiefs. Which brings me to my next big question for the Labor Party, which is, what kind of man is the party's new leader, Bill Shorten? Is he the person who can clean up the Labor Party? Well, as I describe in my book, Bill was, and he's riding the white horse here, in case it's not subtle enough, Shorten was a pillar of the power structures that did little to stop, and many would say tolerated, the unethical behaviour that so badly damaged the party's reputation. Shorten was a pragmatic minister and a ruthless faction leader. During the Labor leadership contest, Shorten liked to quote Gough Whitlam. That was in part, I believe, because he wanted to avoid people making comparisons with the leader he had most closely styled himself on during his political rise, which is Bob Hawke. Much as Hawke remains a popular figure in the Labor Party, his blokish personal style, I think, is sort of out of touch with modern sensibilities. So having known Shorten, and I struggle to call him Shorten because he's always Bill to me, but it sounds a bit too familiar to call him Bill, closely studying for my book, I've come to the conclusion that the leader that Shorten most closely resembles is Kevin Rudd. To me, both men epitomise the contradictions of the modern Labor Party. They're skilled at wielding the rhetoric of the Labor struggle to bolster their political positions in public. In private, they're either part of or enjoying a joy association with the upper levels of society, the very wealthy. Both men are very strong media performers and adept at manipulating the press. But in private, both have these highly narcissistic personalities. Both men have reached high office and claimed credit for substantial policy achievements, and they deserve credit for that. Yet behind the scenes, they're quite disorganised, sometimes irresponsibly so. When Bill Shorten was a lawyer, a very young lawyer in the workers' compensation at Maurice Blackburn, he was shambolic, disorganised, and I think he deserves probably a bit of latitude for that because he was in his early 20s. When he joined the Australian Workers' Union, he would disappear for substantial periods of time when he was secretary of the Victorian branch and the national secretary. His office wouldn't know where he was. His management style was so unreliable that his secretarial staff used to joke that they should get T-shirts with the words "I survived Bill Short" written on them. I spoke to a senior advisor in a Labor government who once met Bill at a public event. And even though they didn't know each other, Bill, who was a fantastic networker, said he'd like to meet this person for a chat another date. Perfectly reasonable request. When they finally agreed on a date and time, this person, who was a pretty senior guy, and he was from Sydney, he turned up at Shorten's office, the AWU. He waited there for 45 minutes. Shorten didn't show. The secretary didn't know where he was. They called. They couldn't find him. And this person said to me, if he'd ever done this to someone else, he would be so deeply embarrassed, he would want to take them out to dinner or to lunch. He never heard from Shorten again. During my research for Downfall, ministerial advisor told me that Shorten had developed a reputation for cancelling public engagements at the last minute. Now, this is not a good sign. As a cabinet minister, reliability is incredibly important. And for someone who aspires to be prime minister, as Shorten obviously does, it's absolutely essential. Now, that said, don't get me wrong, Shorten has some incredibly positive characteristics, and I want to describe them now. He's got two things which have propelled him to the top of Labor politics. He's got an incredibly compelling personality, if you meet him in person, and a strong grasp of strategy. If Bill can learn to project his personal charm through television, and Chris is a much better expert on this than I am, I think he could generally become a popular politician in the vein of Hawke or Tony Blair or even Howard. Secondly, throughout his career, starting in Young Labour, Shorten has shown this uncanny ability to position himself in winning positions. After his brief stint at Maurice Blackburn, he joined the Victorian division of the AWU. The union was demoralised and in disarray from a corruption scandal, the famous AWU slush fund that the Australian's been writing about. By 31, Shorten was the state secretary, membership was on the rise, the union appeared to have been fixed financially, and morale was much higher. He became national secretary, then the spokesman for the Beaconsfield miners. In many ways, he became the modern face of the trade union movement. In the party, he put aside some of his early Young Labour allies and aligned himself with some very skilled operators like Stephen Conroy and David Feeney. They split the left, they put the right into power, took over control of the state division, and got Shorten a federal seat, a safe federal seat of Maribyrnong. Now, today, the Victorian right has surpassed even the New South Wales right in terms of federal caucus representation, which is actually quite a seismic shift in the history of the Labor Party, federally. When Shorten got to Canberra in 2007, Rudd blocked his path to power. Rudd hadn't taken him as seriously as he wanted to be taken and put him in this policy backwater of disabilities. Now, what Shorten did was he brought together all the interest groups and disabilities. These groups had been fighting against each other for years, turned them into this potent lobbying force and led them and pushed through the NDIS. But the problem was is that Rudd didn't take Shorten as seriously as he wanted to be taken. So Shorten led the push against him. In return, he was promoted to the ministry under Gillard. Then he was promoted to cabinet. When Labor MPs finally, out of sheer political exhaustion, made this Faustian pact to return to Rudd, Shorten split with the AWU, which is Gillard's power base, supported Rudd, helped get Rudd elected, and got promoted again. So the pattern that emerges from his career is a man prepared to do almost anything, including abandoning close allies and sacrificing personal friendships to obtain power. Now, to me, the really interesting message from the Labor leadership ballot is that both regular party members and Labor MPs have correctly perceived his political character, although obviously very few people express it in the terms I have today. The fact that 60% of party members voted against him showed that they want more of an idealist as party leader. The fact that 63% of Labor MPs voted for him shows that they want a leader who can, at the very least, position the party to return to power. Because Shorten and the Labor Party are going to need every ounce of his ruthlessness and determination to defeat Tony Abbott, who has 13 years more parliamentary experience than Shorten and has already taken down two Labor leaders, one of them twice. Presumably, Shorten's internal rivals, including Tony Burke, Chris Bowen and Jason Clare, are waiting for him to claw back the lost ground before they consider staking their own claims for the leadership. While completely understandable, the Labor caucus's pragmatism carries a cost. Rudd was returned as Prime Minister after spending 3 years undermining the Gillard government. Shorten was made leader even though he was the driving force behind Rudd's removal in the first place, which turned out to be one of the biggest political miscalculations in modern Australian politics. A system of perverse incentives was operating at the top of the Labor Party, damaging behaviour, bastarding the words of Nicola Roxon is rewarded. Loyalty to oneself is shown to be more effective than loyalty to the cause. There's a lot at stake here, not just for the Labor Party. A strong and vibrant Labor Party is really important for Australia. Effective Labor oppositions keep coalition governments honest. Good Labor governments can be brave, progressive and daring. When Labor leads by example, it lifts the quality of the political debate, the conduct of government and contributes to a better society. Labour problems matter for all Australians, and that's why the party needs to be fixed. Thank you.
Chris Allman,
thank you.
Well, thanks very much, Aaron, and thanks to the Sydney Institute for the invitation this evening. I'm delighted to be here. After the Labor Party's recent election of Bill Shorten as leader, I ran into one of the leading figures in the right, I won't say from which state, it would probably give him away, and said, well, what was the feeling on the right supporting Bill? And he said, well, half of us voted for him because we want him to succeed. The other half are willing him to fail. So Labor is genuinely like the curate's egg, good in parts. On one front, the election, nothing has changed. The next rank is preparing for regime change. But there are positive signs. I think the new system of pre-selecting a leader went better than most of the naysayers said it would. And with some fine tuning, it's an innovation that is here to stay. Then again, the division of jobs in shadow cabinet shows that at least there, the factions have the first and last say on what goes on. But I don't think there's any sign yet that Labor has answered or attempted to answer two fundamental questions about the last 6 years. They are, what went wrong and how can we ensure that that never happens again? And perhaps this willful blindness is because to do that means that they have to face some shocking political facts, a shocking political failure. And just to re-emphasise what Aaron said, cast your mind back to the coalition launch in 2007. There, the Lord Mayor of Brisbane welcomed the crown. After that election, he was the leading Liberal figure in Australia. There were Labor governments from coast to coast. Kevin Rudd was one of the most popular new leaders in post-war federal history. Now, just 6 years on, there are only two Labor state governments left. The party's been all but wiped off the electoral map in Queensland and New South Wales. By the end of next year, it's a fair bet that South Australia and Tasmania will have fallen. And so Katie Gallagher in the bastion of the ACT will be the Campbell Newman for Labor. Now that is a bewildering turnaround in a very short period of time, and achieving that is not simply bad luck or bad media, it is bad culture, bad management, and bad government. Now one theory doing the rounds in Labor is that federally it was a good government, but it just failed to get its politics right, or it failed to get its message right. So maybe the answer to Labor's problems over the last years is so painful that true believers just can't face it. It reminds me of when I studied the Gospel of Mark in 1980, and the Gospel of Mark was undergoing something of a resurgence at that stage. It was in the past considered to be a very rough document. The Greek in it was bad. The Christ figure who appears in it is always on the road to the cross. He's a grim, grim figure. And every time he tells his disciples that if you follow me, that means I'm going to die, and you're going to die too, they just don't get it. And the Canadian Jesuit Bernard Lonergan developed a term for this. He called it scotosis. And that is an unwillingness to learn through painful insights, a kind of intellectual blindness. And at this stage, I think the Labor Party is suffering scotosis. It has an intellectual blindness to what happened in the past. Maybe Labor needs to learn, to relearn what it learned after 1975. And after 1975, in the early 80s, I interviewed Bob McMullen, who was for some period of time the Federal Secretary of the Labor Party. After 1975, the party recognised that it had to do a number of things. It had to get the economics of government right. But it also had to work out how it took great ideas, and the party did and does have great ideas, and turn them from policy into practice to get the governance right. And I think part of Labor's problem, that was despite 11 years in the wilderness this time, it has not properly learned how to govern. Now, we've been working on a documentary on the last 6 years of Labor in power, and one of the researchers tells me that from the end of 2006 to the election of 2007, Kevin Rudd made 600 commitments. Think about that. Anyone looking at this distance would conclude that no government could begin to tick off that kind of agenda. Now, think of the scale of some of the pronouncements that were made. To revolutionise education, to recast industrial relations, to fix the hospital system or take it over, to fix the Federation and end the blame game, to spend $4.7 billion building a national broadband network, to fix climate change with a carbon price, to narrow the gap on Indigenous disadvantage, to fix the cost of living through Fuel Watch and Grocery Choice and a petrol commissioner, whatever happened to him, to reduce the regulatory burden on business, to make Australia the financial services hub of Asia, and I could go on. There were a great many more. Any government would struggle to deliver that kind of agenda across three terms, let alone one. To quote Sir Michael Barber, misquoting Harold Wilson in his book Instruction to Deliver, a week might be a long time in politics, but 4 years is a very short time, and 3 years is even shorter. And in that book, when outlining how government should go about delivering its agenda, he reduced it to five words: ambition, focus, clarity, urgency, and irreversibility. Now, if I could just focus on the first three. The Rudd government certainly had ambition, but it was incapable of focusing on anything for any length of time, and even its friends would suggest it had little clarity of purpose. There's a great image that I think Phil Khoury was the first person to do in the Sydney Morning Herald when he said that Kevin Rudd was like the worst kind of home handyman. He'd take the door off on the first day and think, I'm going to paint that door. And then he'd leave that and cut a skylight in the ceiling but not put any glass. Then he'd take the windows off to paint them. By the end of a month, the house was a wreck. Nothing was actually finished. So during the Rudd government, one of the things that began to strike me was that quite often an announcement was actually seen as some kind of delivery, that once it was said, it was seen to have been done, and then they moved on to the next thing. And if I might be so bold, because I think the Gillard government has a better record on delivery to defend, the National Disability Insurance Scheme and education reform are not yet delivered, let alone even properly funded. That will be the work of other governments. And if I could add my own observation on how you can govern, you can break a lot of promises in politics. People can have and do all the time, but you can't abandon principles, especially when you cast politics in moral terms. When Kevin Rudd said that climate change was the greatest moral and economic challenge of our time, he did two things. He turned all his opponents not just into bad politicians, but bad people. To argue against Kevin Rudd in that circumstance was some way to be morally wrong. And he laid a landmine for himself which barred any passage to retreat. Any return from where he'd been on climate change was a sign of absolute moral cowardice. And that's where he suffered his catastrophic loss of face with the Australian public when he abandoned that idea. And he'd so alienated his own colleagues that on the night of the 23rd of June 2010, when the opportunity came to grab the knife, there were too many hands on it. In the end, there was no ballot. And I think if I can make another observation about June the 23rd, 2010, a lot's been said about the New South Wales disease, about the changing of leaders, and of course that's true. But it was the Victorians that led the charge. And you have to look at the culture in Victoria that had grown up over time. There the right is shattered, so alliances are endlessly formed, broken and reformed between parts of the right and some of the left. This brigand culture sees small bands aligned briefly for their own benefit, and no one commands any great numbers. And that's something to really be aware of in Labor's caucus at the moment. Look at who supported who in the leadership changes, and you had the right supporting a left woman, largely. The left was supporting a right man. The idea that in leadership challenges in Australia, in federal politics, in the Labor Party, that the factions hold some kind of tremendous sway is not true. In fact, there are tiny little generals, some of them commanding one or two numbers, and everyone trying to pretend that they have more followers than they actually do. And no one trusts anyone else. No one was actually sure if they could trust the numbers on their list. So the Gillard government was built on the rubble of the Rudd years, and it inherited an impossible agenda. And it was born with a birth defect. and that was the sin of the murder of a Prime Minister in the middle of the night for reasons that were never explained. It was the original sin of Julia Gillard's government and something that was never expunged, because she could have been confirmed by the election, which would have taken that away, but of course she wasn't. And so, although she formed a perfectly legitimate government, she was dogged with questions of legitimacy and trust from the beginning, and then she compounded them. Now, her initial instincts were good, to settle this ridiculous agenda that she had inherited and to try and get some work done. But then again, there was the immediate misstep of the carbon tax, which was used relentlessly by the coalition, some might say unfairly, but it's politics, to paint the government and the Prime Minister in particular as someone who couldn't be trusted. Now, that was compounded in the long run by the massive strategic mistake of promising a surplus on a particular date. Again, the government promising something that it wouldn't deliver, and for a government that said it couldn't communicate its message or that was a problem, it certainly got through the message that there was going to be a budget this financial year. When that didn't happen, again, it was a blow to the credibility and the trust that people place in government. Every currency is built on trust. You take trust out of currency and you have nothing. And that's certainly true of politics, where trust is the only currency. And the Gillard government ran out of that currency very early in its life. The thing I started thinking about them even a year into the term was 4 years into this government. This is a government that had grown old before its time. And it was, in essence, just marking down time in the end to its own oblivion. So I think the Labor Party now has to ask itself some very candid questions for the good of the Labor Party and certainly for the good of the country, because no matter what people say about it and in what way they might criticise it, the Labor Party has been one of the great innovating institutions of Australian politics. I think it has a long and strong history in front of it. It just needs to learn the lessons of its past and face up to them. So it has to recast its culture. It has to recast its relationship with unions. It has to focus on signature policies to rebuild trust with the community and work on delivering its transition to government and then to actually deliver. You know, in the Gospel of Mark, there are two endings. The first one is called the shorter Gospel, obviously, and that was the way the author originally intended it to end, and went like this. The original has a young man at Christ's tomb telling Mary and other women followers that Jesus has risen from the dead and that they should spread the word. The women were frightened out of their wits and said nothing to a soul, for they were afraid. But then about two centuries on, a monk thought, that's a pretty bad ending to a gospel. And he wrote one that he thought was better. I hope that there's people inside the Labor Party of goodwill that can act like that second century monk. Thank you very much.
Many thanks to Chris Ullman for the Gospel According to Chris, and to Aaron from reading from the Book of Patrick. I should also say thanks to King and Wood Middleton's for the use of this fine facility this evening. It's been great. And so we come to questions and discussion. There are copies. Janet Grundy has copies of Downfall, How the Labor Party Ripped Itself Apart, by Aaron Patrick. I'm sure Aaron will be happy to sign them. And Janet's also got copies of the Steve Lewis and Chris Ullman book, The Marmalade Files. And I'm sure Chris will be happy to sign them. So we come to questions and discussion. If you get you gentlemen to stand on either side of here, and I'll disappear over there, and then you can just take the questions as they come. Perhaps, Aaron, you come over here, because you'll come here.
Get a glass of water.
A glass of water for your man, Patrick. Yeah, okay. Chris, you stay here. So I just start off. Aaron can come back when he's... Hi, Aaron, when he comes back. Both of you, I think, have focused, not exclusively, but you've focused on culture, management, style. Sleaze is a word that's being used, and there's been some aspect of policy, but I think within the Liberal Party there would be, and I think Brian Loughnane said this last week at the National Press Club, that there's a view that the coalition won essentially on policy. They won on climate change policy, opposition to carbon reduction pollution, carbon pollution reduction scheme or a carbon tax. They won on asylum seekers. They won on the economy. So to what extent do you think that view is correct, that essentially this was there are all these problems that Labor had, but Labor's essential problem was policy? Or do you think that should be refined according to positions you earlier stated? So I'll leave, Aaron, perhaps you go first, then Chris, and then we'll just move on.
Well, look, so I guess we're trying to grapple with, was it policy or sleaze or internal dysfunction that cost Labor the election? I fundamentally agree with Chris's argument, which was, is that the Gillard government was founded illegitimately. That on June 23, you had a group of men, in most of them in their first term in Parliament. That was Shorten, Don Farrell, David Feeney, Mark Abib. And what had happened was they'd come from the state branches where they were big players. And when everyone stood in their way, they had a solution, which was get rid of them, push them aside. So they came to Canberra and they weren't getting the respect or the power that they expected and wanted. And they saw that Rudd's support was crumbling, his cabinet turned against him, and they used that to remove him. But it was an illegitimate removal because he was such a successful Prime Minister in the eyes of many people, and he had that incredible win in 2007. And I think that seed, the decay, as Chris said, which polluted the entire Gillard government, and by the time Rudd came back, Australians knew, Australians had turned against Rudd, and they disliked Gillard, but they also knew in their hearts that Rudd was the person who had destroyed the Gillard government. And the party had destroyed all its own, it entirely destroyed its credibility. And I'm surprised that they didn't lose by more.
Yeah, I think the coalition won on policy. It won essentially being not the Labor Party's policy that they had got their governance wrong. And take one example that Brian was talking about climate change. Well, Kevin Rudd took enormous goodwill on climate change at a time when the people of Australia were actually very perturbed about it. John Howard called it the perfect storm in the lead up to that 2007 election, where you'd had hot summers, a long drought at the end of that, Al Gore turns up with his movie and all of a sudden people think this is climate change and they wanted something done about it. Remember, through the course of those first 2 years, it was the coalition that was struggling mightily with climate change, and it was coalition leaders who were being brought down by that. So I think that, in essence, the Labor Party lost government as much as the coalition won it. Now, that's not to say the coalition didn't run a very, very good campaign. Extremely targeted, very disciplined, but mainly it was focused on pointing out the flaws in the governments of the last 6 years.
I just want to ask you to comment on what steps should or could be taken to improve the quality and the diversity of the Labor Party gene pool. If you take out the union officials, the state secretaries and officials, the insiders who have spent their whole working life in a ministerial or member's office, there are very few people who have ever employed someone. Very few people have had to balance a balance sheet or read a balance sheet without the ability to draw on a deficit to run a business. The Liberal Party's perhaps slowly tending the same way with insiders, but it seems to be much worse, and much worse in the Senate, that you don't have a diverse gene pool. I think in Rudd's cabinet, the only person who had a trade who'd ever worked in a dirty job was Joel Fitzgibbon. Everyone else had university degrees, but hadn't contributed in many ways to the economy.
And Joel Fitzgibbon had been an electrical mechanic up in Cessnock, but he was also one of the... I think he was the first cabinet minister to lose his job, because even though he seemed to be doing a reasonably good job taking on the defence establishment, he got tripped up by the ethics of government. You know, he didn't declare.
And he got the job through his father.
Yeah, and he had that relationship with Helen Liu, and that hasn't gone so well for him either. Look, you're expressing a really it's a really important issue, and it's one that Rodney Cavalier has been very good on. He says, you know, I think his great line is that Ben Chifley couldn't get elected to Parliament today, you know, because he's a railway man. He doesn't have access to a phone out there. But also, I think he misses the point. The reality is now politics is a profession, and I think we, as a society, we have to come to terms. We have to accept that the idea of drafting in these brilliant outsiders, particularly as they do in the American system, is probably romantic, and it's not going to happen, because modern politics is a profession. It's a profession like the law and accounting and consulting, and I think you're going to see more of that, not less of that, which is people spending the whole lives in politics. Now, I'm not saying that that's a good thing, but I think we have to accept it and then hope that the process builds, that process can still build up decent people who have a broad view of life and who have broader interests than just, you know, stacking their branches or factional games.
I'm always a bit worried about criticising the quality of former candidates and things when there are august former senators sitting in the audience here this morning. Of course, there are some great Labor Party people right across the spectrum. You know, one of the things I think that's got to happen with the Labor Party, when it talks about its relationship with the union movement, it doesn't necessarily have to split that relationship, but I think what the union movement has to start to do is to broaden its own base of who it might be inviting into its tent. And I think it's an enormous opportunity for the unions to get involved in helping out small businesses. You think about the things that small business people struggle with every day. If unions could become a one-stop shop to deal with all the, not just industrial problems, but the sorts of things that they face on a daily basis, I think they could actually start broadening their base. And that's it in the end, is that if the Labor Party wants to be a party of government, it has to appeal to a larger section of the community, not a smaller one. At the moment, it's chasing an ever smaller part of the community, at least in the people it draws from. It's got to work out a way to broaden its base. Now, you know, greater minds than mine will start applying themselves to that, but I certainly think it doesn't have to break its traditional links with the union movement. They just have to change, and the union movement has to modernise itself a bit.
You think with Bob Carr resigning so quickly and apparently earning about $30,000 before the Senate sits again, it's so hypocritical, that that will just undermine faith. And then also, if they put in as his replacement a local member who was just rejected by their electorate as a job for the girls, perhaps, in this case.
I'll just have to give that to Aaron. Oh, Chris,
Chris, Chris calls it much more closely to me, so he's probably a better place to answer. But look, it's not a great look. You know, Dev O'Neill did get kicked out. Mike Kelly, he got kicked out. He wants the seat too. Doesn't it show that Parliament's a club, right? And the parliamentarians, I know that some ex-ones here, have a strong affiliation with each other, often across the aisle. And so they work to protect each other. So, but, you know, wouldn't it be great, you know, putting aside Bob Carr's incredible cynicism by freestanding, wouldn't it be great if they had picked a young person, perhaps early 30s, late 20s, who had the potential to be a national leader, you know, someone with great integrity and bravery and intelligence? Wouldn't that have been great? I don't know Deb O'Neill, so I don't know if she's in that category or not.
Oh, look, the other thing too is that you get the argument about one of the reasons that Deb O'Neill is being pushed up rather than, say, Mike Kelly is because Deb O'Neill is backed strongly by Shoppers Union. They wanted a vote in the Senate that made sure that there wouldn't be someone who was going to vote for gay marriage. That's one of the arguments that put forward. Again, if you start to break down politics by just those sorts of things, and I'm not saying that's even correct, but that's one of the theories that's put around. So no, the Bob Carr thing isn't a good look for the Labor Party when it comes to replacing the senators. You know, Deb O'Neill was a very good local candidate, though, so you know, she might have fallen short, but she wasn't by no means a dummy, and certainly Mike Kelly, I think, is a loss to politics. I actually think Mike Kelly is a very, very good representative, and I would like to see him back in Parliament again one day.
So we're going here, we're going
to go with Justin. The notion that, or the generally accepted idea that the Rudd government was disastrous, the first government was disastrous, what is so terrible then about the party getting rid of that disastrous leader, and have the reforms for the election of leader made the position of Labor leader a more poison chalice for the party than for the leader?
Look, I thought on the night that Kevin Rudd was deposed, that was the end of him. We'd never see him again. Completely underestimating the nature of the man. In fact, that he had this inexhaustible capacity to just keep coming. He's, as one of them said, he's like the Terminator. You know, cut his arms and legs off, he just keeps moving. There's just nothing you can do about the guy. You have to admire that level of determination in somebody. It was perfectly understandable at the time. I thought at the time that if he had retired gracefully and let Julia Gillard have a bit of a run, things would have gone better. That's not the way that they worked out. And look, I don't think that it's understating it to say that there was an enormous amount of concern, not just in the Labor Party, but in government circles in Canberra about the way that the administration of the Prime Minister's office was running. It had gotten to a stage where everything had backed up in the Prime Minister's office and it was building up pressure all the time. There are a lot of things that were not being achieved. In fact, to give her her due, what used to happen is that the bureaucrats would save things up for when Julia Gillard was acting as Prime Minister and put things in, and she'd shuffle it all through in 24 hours. So, no, I don't think that necessarily there's anything wrong in thinking about getting rid of him. However, I do think, as John Howard thinks, he would have won the 2010 election, and perhaps sometime after that would have been the time to think about a change at the top.
Now, we don't have a lot of time. We'll go here and then here and then here. It's got to be
brilliant.
Just go.
Well, I was very, very proud to have been a member of the Hawke Cabinet, and in relation to your story about the gene pool, I think in the Cabinet there was only Hawke, rather Keating, Young and me that didn't have the university degree, and I think we probably all made a fair impression. My mind goes back to 1948. I'm old enough to have joined the party then, when Gerard would know about this, when the Catholic Church was instrumental in getting the communists out of the trade unions. My father was a union official at the time, a little bus driver, and was very much part of that. And James Carroll, Bishop James Carroll, was instrumental in making sure that the Labour Party was not taken over by the Catholic Church. I find exactly the same situation now, when the trade unions have taken over the Labour Party to its detriment. And the quicker that some of the ideas that were cavalier that you mentioned are implemented, and the trade unions are seen to be part, supporting part of the Labour Party rather than being a powerful force, the better. And until that happens, we're going to be a backwards party.
Anyone want to respond to that?
I agree.
I'll take it as
good. Okay. Can I just go on from what you were saying a little bit earlier? It seems to me, even this discussion, that where Labour's gone wrong, and I agree with John, it's all about Labour. It's not about what they're trying to win the election to do. Now, Julia, I grant you, was a better administrator, but what we're voting for is like a CEO and team to run a business. I mean, that's what a country is. Okay, there are other things, social things, whatever, but the whole problem from 2007 till now seems to have been that the people who've won government didn't seem to know what and how to rule it. And to me, it had something to do with ideological blindness. It had, I mean, even Julia seemed to, she was a very nice person, I interviewed her or whatever, but they were talking down. And to me, it seems like they've all got university degrees, unlike John, and they seem to think they have some sort of received wisdom, and then there is a tendency to hector us all and tell us to come follow them. What's the problem with Labour? When is it going to start realising why it wants to win?
Anyone got a university degree can handle that.
No, mate, you got the masters, not me.
Yeah, it was in public policy, not political philosophy. Look, that's a pretty profound observation, and I think it's absolutely spot on. Does it go to the heart of what it means to lead and be a politician? And does it matter if politicians are supremely self-interested? And there is an argument that it doesn't. There is an argument that personal ambition can lead to good public policy, which is fundamentally what we're after, just as well as, you know, the most principled person. And I guess, as much as I agree with you, we also have to understand the reality of human nature, which is to seek power and glory for ourselves, and politics is very good at attracting those people. What really matters is that you have the systems and the controls and the democratic process to ensure that those people are running political parties, that they do it in an ethical way which benefits society.
We've got 15 minutes, we've got time. Okay, go be quick.
Yeah, a lot of people my age see the Greens as the only alternative to the Coalition and Labour. They are left-leaning, but they see Labour as, you know, asylum seekers, climate change, gay marriage, as basically following the Coalition policies. To what extent should Labour factor in the Greens as it moves forward in formulation of its policies?
Yep, well, it has to, because the problem with the Labour Party at the moment is being dragged apart on the left and the right. So on the left, on its left flank, it's basically, and the people who are supporting the Greens are genuinely tertiary educated people, and they are not just young, they're of any age. And they tend to be a particular type of tertiary education person. So they're people who work in the public service. They're nurses, they're teachers, they're people who work in the humanities rather than people who work in the sciences. So there is a particular demographic on the left of the Labor Party. If you like, I think part of the hard left of the old Labor Party too has migrated there, so it might never come back. And on the right, obviously, they're old blue-collar base. Actually a very conservative group of people. You know, that's the Howard Battlers. These are conservative groups of people. So it's got a real dilemma there. It is just, I think, a matter of articulating what it is to be a Labor Party in the 21st century and to regain the public's trust. Now, neither of those things is easy to do, but I don't think it's impossible to do. And don't forget, this is the oldest Labor Party in the world. This is a party that was with us at the foundation when the foundation stone of government was struck. I think it's an incredibly important political institution in Australia. I also think that it has a potentially a very bright future. And if I could just put in a note for some politicians and some Labor politicians, for those who don't know, I'm married to the member for Canberra. She is a Labor politician. She's the best person I've ever met. She and others in the Labor Party that I know are genuinely struggling to work out how they do the best thing that they possibly can for the community, as there are people of goodwill in the coalition who feel exactly the same way but follow different lights, as are there people in the Greens. Think about this. In the end, most of our political business gets done and nobody dies. You know, and mostly for the last 112 years, this country has been very well governed by both major parties. We should be grateful for that.
To both of you, and following up from the last question, I don't know whether you pick it up in your book, Aaron, but on the question of downfall, but we've now got two Labor governments left, certainly a left-leaning one in South Australia and one that has an alliance with the Greens in Tasmania, and they're now talking about even wanting to break that alliance. How much was the decision to form the alliance of the Gillard government with the Greens part of the downfall, and is there a shift then as a consequence of that relationship has now gone and we don't want to have any more, and sort of that picks up to some extent of the demographic you were talking about as well, Chris, so I'd like to get some comments from both of you.
I think that the deal with the Greens is inexplicable to me, that absolutely inexplicable, because the Labor Party had put enormous pressure on, it was only the House of Representatives where Labor needed the numbers. The Labor Party had put enormous pressure on Adam Bandt to declare his hand. They ran a campaign which was a vote for Bandt is a vote for Tony, is a vote for the coalition. He declared before the election that he was going to vote for the government. And so why Julia Gillard ever felt it necessary to form an alliance with the Greens is absolutely inexplicable. And then it's one thing to say you're a good negotiator. I would be a good negotiator too if I gave you everything you wanted. That's not good negotiating. Good negotiation is holding out for your line as well. And so I think that, you know, again, it dragged the government into territory it didn't need to be in, and it could have handled the carbon price in a completely different way.
We've
got a question here.
So is not the reason that the government fell a lack of political competence and even more so a lack of competence in delivery of policy? So it's completely wrong for the Labor Party to assert that they lost government because they had a good policy but they just didn't communicate it well. Aren't they profoundly incompetent on both those bases?
Well, whether they are incompetent or not on the policies of the government is the debate raging at the moment, and I don't feel that anyone's come up with a killer analysis which proves it either way. The budget clearly you've got, say, the Kerry and Walshes, who argue that it was a brilliant government and they got a lot of legislation through, and then you've got on the right saying, well, you couldn't even balance the budget, you know. That's the starting point for good governance, right? Okay, so putting that aside, politically, well, Julia Gillard may well have been a victim of Rudd, and she was. But, you know, she did the deal with Peter Slipper. She made Peter Slipper Speaker, Sorry, I just read the text messages. You know, how could he be your guy? Craig Thompson. You know, she allowed Craig Thompson she didn't stop Craig Thompson being pre-selected for 2000 in 2010. the AWU scandal. Sure, it happened before she got into Parliament, but you know, I think that hurt her a lot too. So I think there was incredible political incompetence at the very top. And if you speak to Gillard's strongest critics within the Labor Party, within the left, the people who've known her since the start of her political campaign, they would say that she always showed bad political judgment. And they would say they tried to keep her out of Parliament for years, and they were astounded by her rise. You know, and it was the right who put her in, because Feeney and Shorten and Conroy thought, well, they could control her. And that's why they co-opted a left MP to be Prime Minister. And I think there's probably some truth in that.
Yes, you probably sort of cut half of what I was going to say out there, Kevin, because speaking as a former General Secretary of the AWU and a former Senator, the comment I wanted to make, and then come to a question, is that what's not canvassed that widely is the dislike, the hatred of Rudd that existed within the caucus pretty much from the election, not long after 2007. There are a group of people there, I know, you mentioned a couple of them, the part of the books, but there were a group of people, ex-union officials and union officials outside of the Parliament, who were out to get Rudd at some point. Now, I'm not suggesting they had a plot that was well developed.
You mean pre-2010?
Certainly. There was a group called the Knights Templar who threw them out on talked about the Cardinals recently. Yeah, and there's no doubt that Rudd was hated by people within the AWU, by old union, including one. Now, this we could discuss this all the time. I don't want to. But that's true. He was not a popular person in caucus. And, eventually, there were things like the mining tax where a number of people from states, such as Mark Bishop from Western Australia and Don Farrell from South Australia, who did not support the mining tax. So there's a lot of history there as well about, why they got rid of Rudd rather than this shambolic government that people talk about. Because at that time they were boasting about what they would do with the GSC. The question I wanted to come to, though, is to pick up John Brown's point, and that is, what are the reforms that we can make, the party can make, in terms of its relationship with the union movement? Because that's going to dominate the discussion for the next year, and we don't want to end up like Simon Crean did, arguing about percentages and in the end destroying his leadership. So there's got to be some more fundamental reforms than just issues about whether union members get a vote for the leadership.
Okay, thanks. So we ended up with a discussion about unions. Is Labor going to end up like it was with Simon Crean, or is there another way out to resolve that issue?
Reducing union power in the Labor Party is one of the hardest things to do. I can't think of anything harder, because the leaderships of the union movement and the Labor Party are financially and personally entwined. And it's not realistic at this point to break that. It just couldn't happen. The question is, how much should, or if at all, should the union vote in the Labor Party be reduced from 50%? And the reality is it's a de-unionising economy. Less than 20% of working Australians are members of trade unions. Unions are concentrated in certain areas, particularly the public service and some well-off blue-collar areas, such as, gas, areas like that, car manufacturing. Okay, so if the Labor Party is to reflect its voting base, not just broader society, it needs to reduce the union vote. And by reducing the union vote, you fundamentally alter the power balance within the Labor Party. And Paul Howes won't be able to go on Nightline and say, we should get rid of this Prime Minister. Okay? But, Bill Shorten made Paul Howes. Bill Shorten came out of your union, which is out of you. Your union made Bill Shorten. Your union, has made the current Labor Party leader. Your union helped remove the last Labor Party leader. Didn't help bring him back. So who's going to change that? I can't see, apart from Kevin Rudd, who's clearly on the outer, anyone in power in the Labor Party, and Simon Crean's not in power, standing up and saying, let's cut union votes to 25% of conference. No one's going to do that, right? What do you think?
Yeah, I think too, mate. You've got to get some control over what's happening in pre-selections. With factions exercise their control as much as anywhere they can. It's over pre-selections, and so there's a real issue there in candidate selection and then in how those candidates actually make their way to the top. Now, there's a few different ideas going around. Sam Dastyari has one, run one here. You've also got to be concerned in this day and age that you could become captured by very left-leaning groups who basically, you know, end up taking over the party if they think that that's their way in. So it's very... You've done a lifetime of it. If people could easily answer this question, I'm sure they would have by now, Mike.
Just a question on an issue that's been in the news today and that sort of highlights this dilemma of idealism versus pragmatism, perhaps to Aaron. What do you think Labor should do about carbon pricing, and given your knowledge of Bill Shorten, what do you think he will do?
I think Bill Shorten knows that the carbon price is a millstone hanging around the neck of the Labor Party, and he's doing everything behind the scenes to kill their support for it. And what you saw on the front page of Sydney Morning Herald in Mark Kenny's story today is Shorten positioning the party to drop its support for the carbon tax. And what they're saying is, we support an ETS and we want to transition to it. The key thing is, will they vote for the repeal legislation? Okay. And at the moment, the policy is that they have to block the repeal legislation. Tony Abbott's made absolutely clear he's going to play hardball on this, and he'll go to a double dissolution election. And you cannot doubt that that's what he wants to do, or that's what he's prepared to do. Now, how will Australians feel within 12 months we have another election over an issue that you could legitimately claim was resolved this year? They would wreak their fury, I think, on the Labor Party, even if they were angry with Abbott for calling the election. And Shorten knows this, and he hasn't even had a shadow cabinet meeting to discuss it yet. But I think it's very clear that he will, at some point, allow the Labor Party to vote for the repeal legislation while loudly saying we need an ETS.
So there's a final question to both of you. Aaron, you used to be a mate of the Labor leader, the current Labor leader, and Chris, you still are a mate of the Labor member for Canberra. How are you, both of you, in view of what you've written and what you've said tonight and elsewhere? How are you getting on with the Labor Party these days? Is anybody talking to you? Let's go with Aaron and then go with Chris.
Look, Jerry, I was surprised after I wrote this book telling how the Labor Party had ripped itself apart. How many more Labor people started talking to me afterwards and telling me things I wish they'd told me beforehand, which is great because, you know, it shows that they felt the story, they felt the book wasn't biased, it was fair, and the Labor Party people are great people and they're open to a debate about their future.
So, Chris, has anyone identified themselves from the Labor Party in your book here?
Well, I don't know how anyone... For example, just for those who don't know about this work, complete work of fiction, and I can say that because we had two lawyers work on that.
Why would you need lawyers in this fiction?
Well, you just don't know how careful you have to be in this world. But look, it's about a former Labor Prime Minister, now Foreign Minister, with a dicky heart who has a stroke on late line, and mounts a comeback from the hospital bed. Female. Doesn't quite get there in this book, but the second one is underway.
It's been an informative but also enjoyable night, so I'll be very brief. I mean, what's been important about Aaron's work and also Chris's work is that they both talk about politics, but they understand it through personal involvement or close contacts with those who are involved. And we've seen this tonight, and it's evident. It's in the novel and Chris's general reports, but also in Aaron's book. So we've got copies of both books here tonight, Downfall and The Marmalade Files. But for tonight, I'd just like to say thanks to both our speakers for a great job. Well done, Aaron. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well done,
Chris.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.